From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. In what the Israeli daily newspaper Haaretz called an offset to a recent prisoner release, Israel is advancing a plan for some 5,000 new homes in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. Hours after releasing a group of 26 Palestinian prisoners Tuesday night, Israel announced the renewal of several developments in the Jerusalem area on lands annexed after the 1967 war, which Palestinians claim for a future state. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government said it would begin numerous projects across the West Bank, including in isolated settlements and in East Jerusalem, according to the report. Israeli media reports said that the construction plans are far wider than previously announced, involving construction of as many as 5,000 new homes in the West Bank and controversial parts of Jerusalem, adding that most are in the early stages. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon issued a statement saying that he deplored the announcements of further Israeli settlements in Palestinian lands. The statement said, quote, "Settlement activity is contrary to international law and constitutes an obstacle to peace," close quote. The statement added that any measures that prejudge final status issues will, quote, "not be recognized by the international community," close quote. Yesterday, Richard Falk, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in the Occupied Palestinian Territory, held a press conference about his final report to the General Assembly the day before. He addressed the issue of the Israeli occupation and Israel's blockade of Gaza, which has kept food, fuel, and medical supplies out of the city since Hamas took power in 2007 after winning the 2006 Palestinian legislative elections.
I won't try to summarize the entire report, but to just say three things that I think are important. The first is that the developments in the region, particularly in Egypt, have made the situation in Gaza one that is at a point of near catastrophe. It always, for the past years, when the Gaza Strip was blockaded after Hamas came to govern Gaza, it's always been a very difficult situation. It's overcrowded, impoverished. There, Israel has controlled the exit and entry and hasn't allowed export of goods. So the economy has been in great trouble. But since the developments in Egypt, it's been much more difficult for the fishing industry, which is very important for the food supply of Gaza, to operate effectively in the coastal waters, which are so restricted that the areas where the fish are, the Gazan fishermen are not able to go. And there's been a UN report that was issued, I think, last year that indicated even without any further intensification of the pressures on Gaza, the Gaza Strip might become, or was likely to become, unsustainable after 2020. And when we were there in December of last year, we were told by informed NGO workers and also the UN staff there that that was too optimistic, that 2016 was a more realistic estimate of the viability of Gaza, especially in relation to drinkable water and consistent electricity. The other aspect of the recent developments is that patients with serious disease problems that were being treated in Egypt no longer can get that treatment because the Rafah crossing is closed. And I know that there are at least 400 people in Gaza dependent on dialysis machines that were that are in life-threatening situations now, not only because they can't get to Egypt, but because the medical facilities that are available in Gaza are being badly disrupted by power failures that are daily and periodic. So there's not enough electricity, not enough fuel, and there's not enough essential medicine. So it's a real issue that, because so much else is happening in the region, has not received the attention that it deserves. The second issue that I'd mention even more briefly is the issue of corporate responsibility for those companies that are engaged in profit-making activities in relation to the Israeli settlements in the West Bank. And as we've tried to maintain in recent reports, these settlements are, in the judgment of the international community, unlawful, violative of Article 49, paragraph 6 of the Fourth Geneva Convention. And in an effort to move the discourse on the settlements from repeating their illegality to doing something to enforce that conclusion of illegality, we have been recommending in the last year, including my last report to the General Assembly a year ago, that it was appropriate and essential to implement the unlawfulness by encouraging corporations to withdraw their profit-making activities from the settlements. And we have tried to do this in a collaborative way by informing the companies of our judgment that proceeding in this way is problematic. There has been a reinforcement of this view, partly by the EU guidelines that have been issued, and partly by a decision of a important Dutch company, Royal Haskoning, to terminate a project involving the settlements, this in this case in East Jerusalem, and to do so publicly on the advice of the Dutch government, which declared that dealing with the settlements in this manner was, in their words, problematic under international law. And that conclusion of being problematic under international law from a government that has very close and positive relations with Israel seems to us to be a real breakthrough in trying to build a consensus around the conclusion that it is inappropriate and itself complicit in unlawful activity to engage with the settlements on a profit-making basis. The third emphasis that I would call attention to, which isn't so well developed in this report but has been a theme of earlier reports, is the recommendation that the General Assembly seek an advisory opinion from the International Court of Justice as to the status and general legality of prolonged occupation. It is our judgment that an occupation that extends beyond 5 years exceeds what is contemplated by the Fourth Geneva Convention, which seeks to address the problems of protecting the occupied population that is subject to this kind of situation. But to go on decade after decade with a military administration of a territory that is subject to discriminatory legislation and involves keeping the population of such an occupied territory without rights. Indeed, the people of living under occupation, the Palestinians living under occupation, are a supreme example of not possessing the right to have rights. It's a very fundamental condition, and I think it would be useful to have an advisory opinion that reinforces this conclusion. We don't have the expectation that Israel would comply with an advisory opinion of the International Court of Justice. They didn't do so in relation to the 2004 advisory opinion on the separation wall constructed with unoccupied Palestinian territory. And in that advisory opinion, 14 out of 15 judges agreed with that conclusion. And so it is as authoritative a determination of the relevance of international law that one can possibly obtain in the way in which the world is organized. And in that sense, the word advisory is very misleading, because this is a genuine determination with careful legal reasoning of the best legal minds from a broad range of countries. And it should be treated as authoritative guidance on the nature of international law's bearing on a situation of this sort. And the only really operational relevance of advisory opinion is to suggest that it doesn't automatically qualify for enforcement by the UN Security Council. But other than that, in my view, it has an equivalent status to any decision by the International Court of Justice.
Meanwhile, earlier today, Israeli soldiers shot and killed a 22-year-old Palestinian man during confrontations in the northern West Bank village of Kabatia, according to the town's mayor and a local hospital. The mayor, Ali Zakhar May, said Israeli troops entered the town very early in the morning to arrest local residents, and on their way out, 4 hours later, a small group of young Palestinians had blocked the road with rocks and tires and threw stones at the soldiers. The soldiers fired rubber bullets and tear gas and live bullets, killing Ahmed Tazaza, according to the mayor. Kabatia resident Shawkat Kmiel said soldiers broke into their home to arrest his son. He said, quote, "It was 1 a.m. when I heard loud banging on the door, but before I was able to open it, the soldiers broke it down and barged in," close quote. He said when he asked what they wanted, they told him to be quiet and burst into the house looking for his son, Imad, age 30. Imad was arrested along with 3 other people from the town, one of them 60 years old. An Israeli army spokesperson confirmed that the soldiers arrested 4 people. Last week, Israeli troops killed a Palestinian man near Ramallah during an attempt to arrest him. A statement by the Office of Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas said a recent wave of Israeli army killings of Palestinians in the West Bank and a rise in settlement activities are, quote, "destructive to the peace process," close quote, and the current Palestinian-Israeli negotiations.
Yahoo
may have something to yodel about after all. Both Google and Yahoo are reportedly furious at reports that the NSA has secretly tapped their data centers and transactions. The Guardian reports that files obtained from Edward Snowden suggest the NSA can collect information sent by fiber optic cable between Google and Yahoo data hubs at will. and the NSA has secretly broken into the main communications links that connect Yahoo and Google data centers around the world, according to a Washington Post report yesterday, also citing documents reportedly obtained from the former NSA contractor turned whistleblower. According to a top-secret document cited by the Post, dated January 9, 2013, millions of records a day are sent from Yahoo and Google internal networks to NSA data warehouses at the agency's headquarters in Fort Meade, Maryland. The types of information ranged from metadata, indicating who sent or received emails, the subject line and when or where, to content, such as text, audio, and video. According to the Post's report, the documents state that in the preceding 30 days, field collectors had processed and sent on 181,280,466 new records, or about 60 million per day. Prior to the current disclosures, NSA Director Keith Alexander had denied spying on either of the two tech giants. Details about the government's programs have been trickling out since Snowden shared documents with the Washington Post and the Guardian newspaper in June. The NSA's principal tool to exploit the Google and Yahoo data links is a project called Muscular, operated jointly with the agency's British counterpart, GCHQ. The Post said NSA and GCHQ are copying entire data flows across fiber optic networks that carry information between the data centers of the Silicon Valley giants. Meanwhile, it appears even the Pope is being watched. The Italian magazine Panorama reported yesterday that the NSA had eavesdropped on Vatican phone calls, possibly including discussions where the former Pope Benedict's successor was under discussion. The Holy See said it had no knowledge of any such activity. Agency spokesperson Vani Vines said in a statement, quote, "The National Security Agency does not target the Vatican," close quote. It added that the assertions that NSA had targeted the Vatican were not true. Earlier today, the British Parliament hosted a three-hour debate on whether Britain's security services were sufficiently well-supervised in the wake of the Guardian's revelations.
The fact of the matter is, oversight to a large extent has been defective, either because of indifference on their part or because the security agencies have not been willing to give such information. The Honourable Gentleman is putting a total gloss on what in the past, and hopefully it has been in the past, have been practices unacceptable to Parliament and hopefully to the British public.
At least one member raised the question of a conflict of interest of some members of Parliament investigating those responsible.
But the crux of the matter as well is who will lead this reform programme? Well, it has to be Parliament. And to be frank, and I, with the greatest respect to honourable members of the existing ISC committee and the chair of that committee, I think there's a concern about conflicts of interest, particularly having former ministers on that committee and as chair of the committee who were previously responsible for intelligence and security services themselves. It could be that members are actually overviewing decisions that they made and are currently being implemented when they were ministers. So I think there needs to be an exercise where there's a demonstration of openness, more openness and transparency, that there's going to be a fundamental review, but that also it is led by those who are above all potential charges of conflicts of interest. And that means, I'm afraid, not the current ISC committee. One proposal has been put forward that there needs to be a discussion within Parliament now about what sort of what agency that we need to take that forward. I think it should be a parliamentary agency. I think the first initial discussion could be through a speaker's conference in which all parties are brought together and we examine the options available to us now. But it needs to be one that is seen to be avoiding conflicts of interest, that is independent, has resources and expertise to advise it, and that is as open and as transparent as it can possibly be.
Another, despite his rather curious pedigree, disagreed.
I have to declare a very obvious constituency and indeed a family interest in this because my parents both worked both at GCHQ and before that at Bletchley Park. My father, Don Horwood, was involved in building Colossus, the world's first programmable electronic computer under Tommy Flowers, and he was one of those people who kept that secret for decades, even enabling the Americans, God help us, to take credit for building the first electronic programmable computer in the meantime. My mother, I only took back to Bletchley Park recently after 60 years' absence, And only then did she reveal to me that she hadn't just been a linguist, as I'd always thought, but had actually been interpreting intelligence as well. And the habit of keeping secrets that do need to remain confidential secret was one of the enormous debts we owe to that generation of code breakers. And of course it continued in GCHQ during the Second World War, during the Cold War rather, and we cannot know about all the secret victories that our intelligence services were winning then and are winning now, and they are having to remain secret, and quite properly so, because if you do cast too much sunlight on some of these things, they actually stop working. It's not so much about endangering the lives of agents always as talking too much in public about the very precise techniques and sources actually makes those sources disappear and makes those techniques more difficult to apply, and that endangers people in different ways. And I'd love to think that we had now entered some kind of safe post-war world where this level of secrecy is unnecessary, but that's simply not the case. We do still face some hostile states and some hostile state intelligence services, and frankly, if the level of cyber attack and counterattack going on now was taking place in some physical realm, it would in some instances almost constitute an act of war, I think. But there are certainly states that are engaged in hostile activity towards this country. But of course there are the new threats of terrorist networks and organised crime that we know about.
Nevertheless, British Prime Minister David Cameron appears determined to try to shoot the messenger instead. Investigative journalist Tony Gosling spoke with RT earlier today.
We've got something rotten in the state of England. David Cameron is threatening journalists at the same time as he's calling for press freedom. And of course, what that really means is it's press freedom for his story. He doesn't see, I don't think he really wants independent journalism in this country. I think if he could close down The Guardian, he would. He really hates these revelations. Many people may have noticed that his former communications man, Andy Coulson, is in court in Britain today facing these same sorts of phone hacking charges as actually is being accused the GCHQ and the NSA of. These mass data trawls are extremely dangerous and criminal acts. We've seen the security services in this country try and change the law to bring those acts within the law and fail. So effectively what Michael Hastings, the investigative journalist in the United States, was saying is that the military and certain parts of the government, including David Cameron and the people surrounding him, have declared war on the press. And this is why he's attacking The Guardian, is because actually what The Guardian's doing is exposing criminality at high level. David Cameron needs to move out of the way and allow the authorities to actually arrest people who have committed these crimes. The reason why these data trawls are so dangerous is it allows the GCHQ and the authorities in Britain to take out any of their political opponents. We're in a very dangerous state, I think, in Britain. We're moving towards a police state, almost like a Pinochet-type Britain. I mean, we haven't obviously seen mass disappearances and mass arrests, but the police are scared, at least those who are close to the government and the new National Crime Agency, Britain's FBI, are going around arresting the wrong people. What they should be doing is arresting those who have been doing these massive illegal data trawls.
14 Caribbean countries are suing to compel Britain, France, and the Netherlands to pay reparations for centuries of slavery. However, the plaintiffs may have more modest goals in mind. Journalist Glenn Ford from BlackAgendaReport.com asks, how serious is the Caribbean reparations suit?
12 English-speaking Caribbean nations, plus Haiti and the South American country Suriname, are going to court demanding reparations from their former colonial masters for the crime of slavery. Great Britain, France, and the Netherlands, all of which grew fat from generations of captured African labor, would be defendants in a trial before the International Court of Justice, the world body that adjudicates disputes between nations. The black countries have hired the British law firm Lay Day, which won a settlement from victims of British torture in Kenya. Judging by the way the lawyers tell it, this is going to be a very polite affair, in which the Caribbean countries will angle for some type of relatively modest money settlement. By relatively modest, I mean that real reparations would be enough to forever sever the relationship of subservience of the former slave colonies to the global systems of white supremacy and European rule. Real reparations means nothing less than a revolution in global power, because without such a revolution, those nations that became rich from slavery will maintain their position as overlords deep into the future. $10 or $50 billion in payments divvied up among the plaintiffs in a lawsuit will not change the basic master-slave relationship that has obtained since Europe embarked on world conquest 500 years ago. Unless there is a fundamental political change within these Caribbean nations, such as occurred in Cuba, then any exchange of money will only reproduce the existing neocolonial relationships. If the leadership of the Caribbean governments is incapable or unwilling to build new social relations at home, they cannot be expected to use reparations money to build true independence internationally. I strongly suspect that what is really on the table is an aid package in reparations wrappings, which would be an insult to the ancestors and a deception of the living. Let me make this clear. The Europeans on both sides of the Atlantic owe their relative prosperity to the millions of enslaved Africans and to other peoples whose lives, lands, and cultures were stolen in order to build the global white empire. There is no question that the debt must be paid if there is to be any semblance of justice in the world. But no court sitting in The Hague, in the Netherlands, or anywhere else is going to dispense justice on a global and historical scale. Justice means taking Europe and the United States off the throne that was built on the bones of slaves. A just settlement of the monstrous crime of slavery would upend the current world order. Anything less is merely a payoff to black politicians to make the historical indictment go away. So, I am for reparations internationally and here in the United States. Most of the Caribbean leaders, on the other hand, are already allowing their British lawyer to telegraph that all they really want is a nice package of aid with a reparations bow tied around it. They signal an eagerness to settle even before the proceedings begin. However, something useful may come out of this. The Caribbean nations say they will conduct an intense study into the many ways that slavery has hindered their national development. This could be a very educational exercise for the people of these countries. They might learn something about the real workings of power and use it to overthrow their useless leaders and help start a world revolution to bring real reparations. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
And finally, while federal hearings opened October 23rd in Detroit to allow the bankruptcy of that city, demonstrators in Cleveland picketed the corporate law firm Jones Day in solidarity with Detroit workers. Jones Day attorneys are representing Detroit in collusion with their former employee, Kevin Orr. Kevin Orr is now the state-appointed and unelected emergency manager, empowered to make decisions over the heads of elected city officials and the people of Detroit. Jones Day also represents Bank of America and United Bank of Switzerland, two main creditors in the bankruptcy, and we will continue to follow this story as it develops. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio in New York, I'm Don DeBar. Thanks for listening.